Chat with Traders, episode 51.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
Hey there, what's up? Thanks for listening in to episode 51. I have a brilliant guest on the show this week who I can almost guarantee you've never heard of. He generally likes to fly under the radar, but thankfully for us, he did agree to an interview. His name is Bryce Edwards. Bryce is an Australian equities trader. He takes a discretionary approach and makes his money from intraday price movements and goes home flat at the end of each day. During the interview, we walk through the 10 plus years in the build up to Bryce becoming a profitable trader. He's got a really interesting story, and you may even discover it's quite relatable to your own scenario. We also talk about how the order book plays a key role in his trading decisions and how he creates a stocks and play watch list using catalysts such as company news, underlying commodity prices, and broker upgrades and downgrades. Now, if you have any comments or questions for Bryce, just go to chatwithtraders.com/51, scroll to the bottom of the page and drop a line in the comments area. He mentions at the end of the interview, he's more than happy to answer any questions you may have. So I really encourage you to take full advantage of this. All right, well, let's jump to the interview. You're listening to the Chat with Traders podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Fifield, and please welcome my guest for episode 51, Bryce Edwards. Bryce, what's up? How's it going, man?
Good, Aaron. How you been?
I've been all right. Now, the market's just closed. How'd you go today?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. There's been a lot happening on the corporate front in Australia. Big earnings downgrades and big moves in a couple of stocks. So it's been quite a lot of action this week. It's been good.
That's excellent. Nice. Well, Bryce, thanks for agreeing to an interview. I know it's not something that you normally do, but you've got an interesting story, and I think that many listeners will be able to connect with what you have to say. And one of the things I really like about your story is the fact that you didn't nail trading on your very first attempt. So, I mean, you got into trading, you lost some money, you went into property, then you became a stockbroker, and now you're back into trading and you're doing very well for yourself. So we're going to walk through all of this, but let's start right from the beginning. So tell us how you very first got started in trading. I think it was roughly 10 years ago.
Yeah, probably a little bit more actually. So, my interest was originally sparked by my grandfather. He was probably more of a long-term investor. I wouldn't say he was overly wealthy. So he was actually a sailmaker. He used to make sails for yachts. And, I'm pretty sure he had a number of wealthy clients who, he'd make sales for. And, I'm sure they gave him tips and advice. And, over that period, I think he did okay. This is sort of, late 90s, early 2000s when, it was pretty easy to do well as a long-term investor. He gave me a pretty small portfolio and, he'd follow stocks in the paper and, tell me what he'd liked. And, I'd end up buying them in an online broking account. So I guess that was my first introduction. That kind of went on for probably 2 years and then I actually went with a mate. My mate's mum somehow got in touch with a guy that ran a seminar, and it was an options trading seminar. So this is a couple of years later, and so we plodded along to this seminar, and it lasted for 4 or 5 days, and that was my first introduction to charting and technical analysis. So it was, I guess, a typical black box system. So the guy had obviously back tested it. All we had to do was follow his system into when, one indicator crossed another and sell when such and such happens repeat and we'd get rich basically. So that was the pitch anyway, but, we left the seminar on cloud nine, as you do, talking about which beach we'd be sitting on, while we're trading and making millions, but it didn't exactly pan out like that. So, to be perfectly honest, I don't think I stuck to the system. Originally I sort of just went about trading options willy-nilly, which was, kind of a recipe for disaster. But, I was buying options, so buying puts and calls. I don't think I knew back then that you could be a seller of premium. But I think I started with about $35,000 in my account. And, yeah, within 6 months, I sort of whittled that down to around $20,000 before I gave up. So, yeah, it was pretty ugly. But, you know, considering how green I was, I think, you know, and the fact that I was trading options, I think losing less than 50% of my capital was, you know, probably a pretty good result.
Yeah, no doubt. So what would you say probably led to you losing, you know, not quite half of your account? Like, what kind of mistakes were you doing?
Well, I just had no system. And I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I was so new to it that I didn't really understand methodology. I thought it was a prediction game. And, you know, obviously you soon find out that it's not about prediction. It's more about managing risk. So, yeah, I mean, that was, you know, that was a pretty big loss for me. I think I was 20 or 21 at the time. And, you know, I thought, oh, this is a mug's game. It's for the professionals. I'm not gonna make any money from this. So I threw the towel in on the stock market, and I ended up getting interested in property. So, you know, I focused on that for about 5 years, I think. So I actually ended up buying a couple of places in New Zealand. Have you? I sense a bit of a Kiwi accent there. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm from New Zealand. I moved over to Australia when I was 12.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I bought a couple of places over there, and that was, I held them for about 5 years, and then the financial crisis hit, and that was sort of 2008. And, at that time, you know, I was really interested in what was happening on a macro level. So at the time I was working as a mortgage broker, and that kind of complemented the whole property investment thing. And, so I had a pretty good understanding of the whole subprime crisis, you know, the securitization of mortgages. I think I sort of, you know, recognized that they were, you know, bundling up steaming piles of you know what, and selling it on to unsuspecting investors. And, at that time I'd actually discovered the likes of Zero Hedge and, you know, people like Peter Schiff and Mark Farber. And, you know, I got really interested in the whole Austrian economics crowd. And, you know, that sort of led me to be turned into a kind of Chicken Little type character. I thought the sky was falling in, basically. I thought the US dollar was going to collapse. And, I quit my mortgage broking job and sold my investment properties and, put all my money into an account to try for a second time to be a full-time trader. It was a really, really fascinating time to be in the markets. But again, you know, I hadn't really done the research and, there wasn't any method to my trading. I didn't have any discipline, or risk management. So, you know, all I had was a pretty strong view that the world was going to hell. And I thought that, you know, I could pretty much short everything and be long gold and make money. And, it didn't quite pan out like that. So I think, you know, after the first QE program was announced, I had some pretty big wins in gold stocks. But, you know, because I was so bearish, I kept trying to short things like consumer discretionary stocks. And, you know, this is through that 2009 rally. And I just basically tore up all the profits. So, you know, I was shorting really strong stocks in a bull market, which, you know, was a bit of a recipe for disaster. So, shorting things like Flight Center. What else? I think I had a go at JB Hi-Fi. And, you know, even in the US, I tried shorting a couple of names. I remember I had took a pretty big loss in Whirlpool. So that was WHR on the New York Stock Exchange. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, the end result was, you know, no method, poor risk management. I was gambling. So that went on for, you know, I had quite a bit of money in the account. So I think it went on for almost 1.5 years. And, if it wasn't for a certain turn of events that stopped me trading, and that is my broker actually collapsed and my trading account was frozen, if that hadn't happened, you know, I probably would have gone about blowing myself up over the course of the next couple of years anyway.
Okay. So, wow, there's a lot to take in there. So let me just ask before we move on, how did you go in property? I mean, did you have, you know, quite decent success there? And is that what allowed you to fund your, you know, your larger size trading accounts?
Yeah, well, I mean, at that time, there was a whole lot of literature out there about positive cash flow property. So that's what I was trying to do, buy properties that generated a rental yield in excess of the cost to finance. And so, you know, there was guys going out there and just, you know, borrowing and buying and borrowing and buying. And because of the cash flow that was being generated, then you could just keep buying stuff. So, that's what took me to New Zealand. I mean, I don't know whether you know a town by the name of Taumarunui, but I mean, you know, I bought a couple of houses over there for less than 40 grand, you know, on a 16% yield. And, you know, within a couple of years, you know, 3 years or whatever, they'd tripled. So it was just right time, right place, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome return. Okay, so I'm not sure where this fits in on your timeline, but you got a job as a stockbroker. So what was this experience like for you? I mean, did you learn anything significant in this role? Tell us a little bit about, you know, being a stockbroker.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, how I actually got into it, I mean, obviously after this broker went under, and, you know, I won't mention the name of the firm, but they're actually based on the Gold Coast, which, you know, in hindsight was probably a bit of a red flag. But, I mean, the end result, I mean, I ended up losing a couple of $100,000. So I was devastated. And, I mean, that was a pretty heavy weight on my shoulders for a number of years there. But, I mean, the end result was that, you know, I hadn't had a job for probably a year and a half. I didn't really have any money aside from what I'd lost in the trading account. I didn't have an income. So, you know, I had to go back into the workforce. And, I had a passion for the market. So obviously thought that getting into stockbroking was a pretty good idea. So, the first 2 years was, you know, really all sales, so cold calling, bringing on new clients, and then eventually, probably in the third year, I mean, I worked for a number of different brokers, but in the third year, I eventually had my own book of clients. So some would obviously trade their own accounts, and, you know, to me, they were the best kind of clients because, you know, you could kind of just sit back and you know, they would generate commission. But then there was others that were really looking for more general advice, stock advice, and I'd, you know, present them with trade ideas and, you know, obviously execute on their behalf.
Okay, so how were you generating those trade ideas for them? Like, were you obviously heavily involved in, you know, research during that period?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, obviously after, you know, 2 years, I went and got all the qualifications and, you know, by the time I had my own clients, I'd finally got around to doing the research on trading methodology and risk management, right? So I'd say that is where the real journey in terms of the world of trading for me began. By the time I'd got my own clients, I'd also, you know, I'd read a whole heap of books. I joined a traders chat room that I think I mentioned to you, you know, when we spoke last time. That's called CFD Traders Edge. So that was run by, or still is run by, a trader by the name of Alan McGrath, who's, now a pretty good friend of mine. And Alan became, I guess, somewhat of a mentor to me. So, you know, I'm in the chat room, you know, I'm obviously doing my work all day, but, I was sponging off him and really watching him get in and out of stocks intraday while I was at work, you know, speaking to clients on the phone. I'm just watching the screens and watching what he was doing. That's how I basically started to pick things up. And, you know, in the beginning, I guess, you know, my results with clients were pretty mixed. Some did okay, others not so well. And, eventually after watching the screens all day and particularly, you know, watching the order book, I call it the order book, they call it level two in America. I really recognized that, you know, perhaps there was an edge to be exploited in trading the order book on a short-term basis. That's kind of when I had a bit of an aha moment. And, I had a handful of clients that were, you know, open to more short-term trading. And that's where I began to have a little bit more success. I did that for a couple of months before I realized that, you know, the economics of short-term trading with a full-service broker, it just doesn't work. You know, I mean, to ensure that I wasn't churning commission out of my clients, I had to drop them to a rate that was so low that, I wasn't really making any money. And, you know, the boss wasn't happy, of course, but, the upside was that I was learning a lot and I was, you know, obviously getting paid to learn. So, it was pretty good to pick things up like that. So,
Cool, cool. Okay, Bryce. Well, let's now drill down into more about the ins and outs of your trading. So how would you describe the approach you now trade? I mean, you mentioned the order book, and of course got a bunch of questions around that to come. But just if you could give us an overview of your approach, and maybe also if you could share with us how this has changed over the past few years, because I believe you were more of a scalper to start out with when you first went from being a broker to trading full time.
Yeah, correct. So, I guess a general classification, I'd probably say that I'm a discretionary intraday stock trader. So I try and go home as close to flat as possible every day. The obvious reason is to minimize overnight risk. But I think for me, more importantly, is that, you know, I can be 100% focused on news plays the next morning. And that way I'm on the offensive. And I found that, you know, initially when I was trying to find my own style, any time that I came in and I had a bunch of stocks to deal with, you know, I'd always have to worry about putting out fires in the morning rather than being on the offensive. So, yeah, I try to go home as flat as possible. Company news, I'd say, is my bread and butter. So that's something that I picked up again from Alan McGrath in his chat room. And, I think I mentioned to you last time that I'm also a big fan of S&B Capital. So Mike Bellafure's book called The Playbook, that, you know, really helped me structure my approach, to trading. I mean, the importance of process, of repetition, and also, you know, the big takeaway for me is this concept of stocks in play. So that was really powerful. I think that came out maybe 6 months before I finished up broking, and it was kind of that book that I thought, hey, you know, the stories of all these young guys that were having a good go at it, and I thought that, you know, that's something that I'd really like to do. So, yeah, I mean, the stocks in play, it's probably the backbone of what I do every morning. So every morning I'm building a list where I'm basically looking to trade stocks that have a catalyst. So my goal is to be in the right stocks every day. That is the stocks that move the most. And I find that, your risk reward is far better when there's a catalyst to drive the move in the stock, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I'm quite keen to read that book also by Mike Bellafure. And Mike has been on the podcast in the past for those listening. If you want to check that out, that's episode 22. Really awesome to have him on. So, Bryce, what markets are you most focused on? Is it just Australian equities, or do you, go outside of those as well?
Yeah, no, 100% Australian equities. I mean, for a while there, I considered, potentially moving across to the US purely for liquidity reasons. You know, I see these guys that are trading those NASDAQ stocks and, you know, making these huge, intraday profits. But I think, you know, I came to the realization that it was, you know, more my self-limiting beliefs than it was, you know, that the Australian market didn't offer the opportunity, you know. So, that's, you know, really where I had to tweak, try and tweak my strategy and focus more on these stocks in play. So, you know, and when I say stocks in play, I mean, yeah, I'm obviously looking for a catalyst, and in particular company news. So, you know, when a company wins a new contract or they announce an earnings upgrade, that's the sort of thing that, I'm interested in. And also I think, you know, with these types of trades, if you time your entry correctly, oftentimes you'll be in profit, you know, right from the get-go, and they kind of move quite quickly. And so, you know, you can potentially run quite a bigger size position and have a really tight stop loss so that your risk is small, but your upside's quite big if you time your entry right and the stock goes in your favor. So I think, you know, that's something that works quite well. And obviously when there's a catalyst, you know, around company news and that sort of thing, you get bigger volume and more liquidity as well. Trading company news is the main focus. But, I mean, there's heaps of different types of catalysts that you can look for. I mean, I mentioned to you that I also trade around broker upgrades and downgrades. That tends to be a good catalyst, particularly now. I mean, in Australia, it's AGM season right now. So you get quite a number of companies that will bury a trading update within the chairman's AGM address. So when the chairman's addressing the meeting, that address has to be released to the market prior to it actually happening in real time. And so the stock might not move much in a day, but you might find that the broker, you know, sees something in the trading update that they like, and they might upgrade the stock overnight. So let's say they upgrade, you know, from neutral to overweight, and that tends to generate a lot of institutional flow the following day. I mean, it depends on the broker. You know, if it's a retail broker like Bell Potter or CBA, you know, they don't have institutional clients that are following the flow. But, you know, these bulge bracket banks with Citibank, Credit Suisse, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, they tend to have a lot of institutions that act on their research. And so they're the ones that, that can often generate good flow. And, yeah, so the broker calls can be great catalysts.
Okay, cool, cool. Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. And I'm keen to ask a few more questions around that as well. But just right now, before we move on, I want to zoom in on the order book because I know this plays a really important role in your trading. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the order book is just the same as the tape or level two for, you know, those listening, you know, outside of Australia.
Yep.
Why is the order book such an important part of your trading?
Well, I mean, for me, you know, I started off scalping the order book and then sort of moved more towards also trading charts as I increased the size and the hold time of my positions. But, I mean, my original theory was that, hey, you know, if you're looking at a chart, you know, it's kind of like driving, looking in the revision mirror. It's past tense, you know. What needs to happen for, you know, a trade to take place to then print on the tape is that two orders must mean. You know, so in terms of predicting the short-term move in a stock, the order book is you know, at the very forefront of where the trade's happening. And so that to me was a really big, you know, kind of aha moment. And it's sort of gone forward from there. So, I mean, in terms of my decision-making process, it is heavily weighted toward the order book. And, you know, also I think, you know, that definitely comes down to market microstructure. So, yeah, there's a really big difference between the Australian market and the US market in terms of microstructure. The order book in Australia is, you know, I'd say it's probably a whole lot more reliable. So, for example, you know, looking at the order book, I mean, I'll use the order book to manage risk. So if I, you know, go to buy a stock, oftentimes I'll spot my exit in the book below, right? So if I'm going to buy a stock, I'll see a big line of bidders behind me that, you know, if things don't work, you know, generally if I put a trade on, it doesn't go in my favor straight away, then there's a good chance that it's probably not a winner, right? And so having those big bidders behind me that I can turn around and hit out on and stop my trade out, you know, I found that was a certain element of risk management in it. So the volume or the size of the bids below is going to help me determine my position size in terms of risk management. So, you know, let's say I want to take a $10,000 position in a stock. If it's quite an illiquid stock and there's only, say, 2,000 units within close proximity bid below, then I'm not going to take 10,000 units because I don't know that I can get out, you know, within close proximity my whole 10,000 units, if that makes sense. So I think that's a really big difference. I mean, I think you'll find if you speak to a lot of US traders, they'll say that, you know, because of market makers and whatever else, you know, all the spoofing and phantom liquidity that goes on in the States, I think you'll probably find that those bids that, you know, I'm relying on to hit out on, that, you know, there's a good chance they're not going to be there in the States when you want to exit. And that's because of the market microstructure. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. So, I mean, this is something we've spoke a little bit about in the past, and I don't know, you may have kind of touched on it there. You say that the Australian order book is lit, and there's a big difference between that and how that compares to the order book or the level two in the States. So could you just explain what you mean by the Australian order book is lit and how that differs?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously there's the lit market and, you know, dark pools, right? So, you know, the US market, obviously they're lit markets as well, but, you know, it's a little bit different. So let's say, for example, in Australia, you can't really mask the size of your order like you can in the States. And, you know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I don't do a lot of US trading at all. So, you know, perhaps I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that in the US, you'll see, you know, a heap of 100 lot bids in the book. And so that could be someone that's trying to buy 100 lots, 100 units genuinely, or it could also be someone that's trying to buy 10,000 units and they're actually masking their order, right? So they're only revealing the first 100 units of their order. And so that's what I mean by masking in a true lit book. You know, in Australia, you can't mask the size of your order. So what you're looking at, I mean, what you see is what you get for the most part. You know, I mean, we've got icebergs and, you know, different special order types, undisclosed bids, undisclosed offers. There are a number of different institutional orders that you know, kind of allow you to hide your liquidity. But for the most part, you'll find that, you know, if you see a really big sell wall with say 40,000 units offered and you lift the lot, you're going to make the stock run, you know. So you can tell how much it takes to break a stock in terms of, like, you know, the order book. And you know, when a stock cracks, you know exactly what it's going to take to make the stock crack. So I think that's a really big advantage. And I think, you know, without that, I think, you know, I'd probably be more reliant on the tape and also on charts. But, you know, because of the microstructure, I think you can put a little bit more weight to the order book when you're trading. And, you know, I mean, outside of the order book, I mean, in terms of microstructure, you know, it's quite different. So it's probably a little bit interesting to go over this, right? So in Australia, there's only two exchanges. The ASX is the major exchange. So they basically used to have a monopoly. They still do. I think it's probably around 90% of the total turnover happens on the ASX, right? And, you know, there's a second exchange called the Chi-X. That only launched probably 3 or maybe 4 years ago now. And they do the remaining 10%. Right. So when I'm looking at the order book, I mean, I don't even really look at the Chi-X because, you know, the Chi-X is where you get a lot more algo activity, a lot more HFT. And so I'm only really looking at the order book or the level two on one exchange, the ASX, and they do 90% of the turnover. So it's very, very different. And, you know, you compare that to the States. I mean, how many exchanges has the States got? They, you know, 16 or 17 different exchanges and God knows how many dark pools. So there's going to be a lot less HFT, a lot less market making in Australia because, I guess, you know, there's a lot less opportunity for this kind of latency arbitrage that happens between exchanges. So, yeah, it's a big difference.
Sure, sure. No, well, thank you very much for, you know, going into that, Bryce. That's really fascinating. Now, one of the types of trades that you focus on, you describe as trading a wall. And this might be a little bit difficult to describe without, you know, visualizations, but could you give us just an overview of what this type of trade looks like and what causes these walls to occur?
Yeah, sure. As I say, I mean, without, you know, having an order book in front, it makes it a little bit difficult. But, you know, what you'll find in the order book is, you know, there might be orders that gather around a particular price point. So if you have a large line of stock offered at a particular level, and that stock might be, you know, that line of sellers might be, say, 10 times the amount of stock that's offered on any line or price difference right next door. And so when a big line like this wipes in the market, that's a sign to the market of conviction. You know, so I often trade around walls, and oftentimes you'll find walls, you know, at particular points of, you know, resistance and support. And so say, for example, if a stock has, you know, a resistance of $6, you know, oftentimes you'll find a whole wall of sellers at $6. And so what, you know, oftentimes you can play a breakout and predict that wall breaking if you see a lot of activity coming up to the wall and you see bids start to build behind the wall and then someone starts to chip away at that wall, then you would buy that wall. And, you know, the huge volume that's just been done in lifting that offer creates momentum in the stock and then things run, hopefully, in your favor. So trading around walls in the order book, I mean, it's kind of something that it's hard to explain, but, you know, if you're watching the order book enough, eventually you kind of pick it up.
Yeah, and I think you created a video which is available on YouTube, which kind of explains that a little bit more with, obviously, visualization. So what I'll do is I'll link to that in the show notes in case anyone wants to check that out and find out a little bit more about it. All right, so besides the order book, I know there are other factors you also can consider, some you mentioned, such as news, commodity prices, broker gradings, etc., which I'd all like to ask you about in just a minute. But technical analysis, does this play a role in your trading? And if yes, how so?
Okay, well, originally it didn't. You know, I was predominantly a really short-term order book scalper. But I guess I ran into some problems in terms of scaling up my, my positions as my account grew. And I found that inevitably, you know, I couldn't just scalp any particular order book setup. And, you know, particularly because I'm relying on the order book for liquidity, I'd get to a point where, you know, I'm going to have to take a bigger position than, you know, the bids behind are going to afford me in terms of risk management. And so that's when trend trading, I changed my style, I guess, to trading with momentum. And, you know, that's where you're able, because the wind's at your back. I mean, let's say, for example, you're trading a strong stock, or buy a strong stock at highs when the market's trending higher. You find that the wind's at your back, and even if things do reverse, there's a lot more liquidity than the order book will actually reveal. And so, yeah, it's really just been a case of scaling up my trading and you know, trying to hold positions a little bit longer rather than being a scalper.
Okay, sure. So let's speak about the additional factors that we've kind of hit on already, but let's go into a little more depth. So, things such as news, underlying commodity prices, broker up and downgrades. What do you like to see happening in these areas? Maybe if you could give us an example of a recent scenario where this has happened.
Yeah, sure. I mean, when this is all in relation to, you know, building a stocks in playlist. So, yeah, in terms of catalysts, I mean, I've explained company news, broker upgrades and downgrades. That there's any type of catalyst, then I'll look for in the morning. I mean, I get up, you know, read two different papers. You know, I've sort of got a set routine that I go to look for to build my list of stocks in play in the morning. In Australia, we're heavily weighted toward resource stocks, and oftentimes you can get some really nice lead-ins from overnight moves in commodities. Moves in commodities can make for some pretty good catalysts. Let's say, for example, nickel might be down, 6% on the LME overnight. And so, I'll come in and look to short nickel stocks. Moves in copper or gold or the oil price, anything that is going to provide a catalyst. And there's also, there's a bunch of US listed ETFs that I also monitor for the same reason. So, oftentimes you'll find, just because gold's up, it doesn't necessarily mean that the gold stocks have been up. So for that reason, in gold in particular, I might take a look at the Huey Index or the GDX, the GDXJ. There's a bunch of different indexes. If crude is down a lot, then, I want to have a look at, which, US energy ETFs have moved. So I think the tickers for the energy ETFs are XOP and the other one's XLE. I think XOP is the one that I look at the most. So there's plenty of places that you can look for a really good catalyst, but at the end of the day, that's only really the first step in the process. Just because a stock is, you know, has a catalyst and it's on my morning list, it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that it's a trade. It's still got to qualify as a trade. So, you know, I'm still looking for a good setup in the order book. You know, I'm trying to time my entry into the trade. And, you know, that's all based on price action, watching the tape, and obviously the order book.
Okay, sure. Well, I'd like to ask you that, but just quickly, on average, how many stocks might be on your stocks and playlist each day, just on average?
Probably 20.
Okay. So how do you go about tracking this list of, you know, let's say 20 stocks throughout the day? Because I'm sure it's very tricky to track the order book of this many stocks. I mean, how do you approach that? Do you utilize any type of technology? Do you have your monitors set up in a certain way? Yeah, it would be great to hear more about this.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. But in terms of, so I basically, you know, start with stocks in play. I mean, the open is a little bit different here in Australia. I'm not 100% sure how it works in Australia, but in the US, sorry. But, you know, we have an auction at the beginning of the day, and then our market opens in five phases. And so it goes group one, which is, you know, all the tickers starting with A and B, group two, the tickers from C, D, E, and F, group three, you know, so there's this five stage or five phase open, and there's 2.5 minutes in between each phase. So, you know, I'll firstly look at all the A's and B's, and then I'll, you know, trade phase one, and then I'll trade phase two and trade phase three. You know, sometimes if, you know, let's say in phase one, you know, I make two trades or one trade, it's really good if that's a winning trade, because then, you know, I don't really have to worry about, you know, trying to put out a fire. I can move straight to phase two. You know, oftentimes if I have a couple of losing trades in the beginning of the five phase open, it means that, you know, I'm kind of tied up trying to stop out trades, and I can't trade what's happening in the later phases. So, yeah, it's kind of a bit of a juggling act for the first 10 minutes. But it's generally the, you know, the first sort of 10 or 15 minutes that I'm trading those stocks in play. You know, I then move to a different kind of process to trade momentum trades from, you know, sort of quarter past 10 or 15 minutes after the open. So, you know, in particular, if the market's really bulled up, let's say we get a really strong lead in from Wall Street, the Dow's up, you know, 1.5%. The SPY futures here are indicating, you know, we might be up 1.5%. And so in the morning, after I've traded that stocks in playlist, I'll then go and look to get, you know, market exposure. And so this is what I referred to before. You know, I'm going to be trading or buying strong stocks, trading at their highs. You know, for the most part lately, that's been, you know, that's been tech stocks. But yeah, I mean, I'll, you know, go and do a bunch of scans for, you know, stocks trading within 2% or 3% of the 52-week highs. That might produce a list of, you know, 100 stocks. And then I'll use a scanner intraday to filter those stocks and only show me the stocks that are trading at their highs. And then I'm just going to go and buy the new high. So that's something that works pretty well in terms of momentum when you've got the market at your back. And that doesn't necessarily have to be news. So that's just, you know, trading with the market. And so if the market's going up, I'm looking to buy stocks. If the market rolls over, I'm, you know, I'm cutting my long positions, and I might start to look for shorts. And the shorts is just the same in reverse. I'm looking to short weak stocks trading at their lows. You know, it's more of a momentum game.
Okay, and you mentioned in there that you were using some scanning software during the middle of the day to find stocks trading at their highs. Do you mind sharing what that is?
Yeah, it's a platform called Spark. It's not available in the US, but yeah, I mean it's a huge advantage. You know, I've got Spark running on four different screens. You know, in terms of using technology, I mean, at the end of the day, as a retail trader, you know, you don't really have an information edge over institutions. Your biggest edge is, you know, your regular, your pretty small size and your speed of execution and your ability to get in and out of the market quite quickly. And I think, you know, if you can use technology to keep more eyes on the market, then, you know, you could potentially trade more of your best setups. And so Spark, you know, there's a whole, you know, different, you know, there's a whole bunch of really cool smart lists and watch lists and ways that you can filter the market to basically push to you, you know, your best setups. And so that's kind of what, you know, I've used Spark for. It's, you know, you've only got two eyes and four screens. You know, there's a limited amount of things that you can see, you know, in terms of what's going on in the market every day. So if you can use technology to bring more trades or more of your best setups to your fingertips, then, you know, hopefully you'll be more profitable.
Absolutely. Now, as a day trader, it's quite can be quite easy to get chopped up with just your commissions alone, you know, jumping in and out of the market a lot. So how do you make a conscious attempt to be mindful of commissions as a day trader? I mean, does that mean that you're only trading your A+, your best setups, or tell us how do you work around that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a really good question. It's something that I struggled with quite a lot in the beginning. The first thing or the first answer is obviously just to trade stocks in play. I mean, when you get much bigger moves in stocks in comparison to your commission charge, then naturally, you know, your commissions are going to eat into your profits a little bit less. So for that reason, you know, I focus in the stocks in play. I generally steer clear of the large cap stocks, you know, things like banks, Telstra, your Woolies and your Wesfarmers. I don't tend to trade those large stocks because they don't really move much during the day. So you just end up, you know, chewing up commission, and I kind of don't really have an edge there anyway. Unless of course it's on news, then, you know, it's certainly in play and I'll have a look at it. But for the most part, yeah, trading mid-cap stocks and trading where there's a catalyst. But I think something that took me maybe a year to really work out is that, you know, you don't need to be trading in the middle of the day. You know, I tend to be way more active in the first hour and then, you know, also in the last hour of trade. That's when things happen. You know, if you're trading in the middle of the day, I mean, oftentimes, particularly if the market isn't trending, you just tend to get chopped up, you know, and you just end up churning commission. So, you know, in the middle of the day, there's got to be a really good reason for taking a trade. You know, most of the money for me is made in the opening hour. So yeah, just be more selective in the middle of the day, I guess. So that's the major, thing that I've sort of come across in the last year. But I think, you know, the easiest way to save on commissions is obviously pay less to your broker. And I think, you know, commissions here in Australia, are really high. I mean, we don't have the turnover. We don't have the economy of scale, or the same sort of, you know, competition that you get in the US. So it is actually quite expensive to trade in Australia. The ASX, as I said before, has a virtual monopoly. The exchange fees, the settlement fees, these are basically input costs to your commission rate as a trader. And so, you know, by global standards, our commissions are really, really high. We in Australia, we get charged on a percentage of trade value. So in the US, you know, people are probably familiar with a cents per share structure, where it's very, very cheap to trade, you know, stocks that are trading at a dollar. And it doesn't work like that in Australia. So, you know, if you're going to trade, you know, $100,000 worth of a small specky, it's going to cost you the same as $100,000 worth of, you know, a large cap stock. So it's a little bit different, and your commission, you know, is quoted in basis points. So, you know, it's if you've got a really small account and you're doing small turnover, you probably shouldn't be paying any more than say 8 basis points. So that's $8 for every $10,000 that you're trading. And it's also pretty important to ensure that your broker doesn't charge you a minimum ticket charge. So, you know, oftentimes you'll see brokers quote, you know, 8 basis points with a $10 minimum ticket charge, which is no good if you've got a really small account, you're only trading $5,000 lots and you hit with a minimum ticket charge instead of the basis point rate, then that's going to eat into your profits. You want no minimums. And, you know, once you start doing a lot more volume, you can sort of negotiate a pretty good rate. I mean, I'm currently on a rate of 2.5 basis points. So that's $2.50 for every $10,000 that I'm turning over, which is really, really competitive. I think, traders in Australia would be surprised that you can actually get a rate that low, 2.5 basis points. So, you know, I won't shamelessly plug my broker, but I mean, if anyone wants, to ask questions about brokers, I'd be happy to help. I mean, I can answer questions on your site, or they can contact me via email. I think getting the right broker is pretty important.
Sure. Okay. And just one thing before we wrap this up, you mentioned in your answer there that, you know, during the middle of the day, you're not overly active. Are you still at your computer, you know, watching the market intensively throughout the day? Or do you find that you leave your computer and go and do something else?
No way. I'm always at my screens. I mean, I'll go down to get lunch for all of about 5 minutes, and then I'm back up eating lunch at my desk. So yeah, if you have a really bad day and you make some mistakes and break some rules and you've put a dent in your account, yeah, sure. I mean, cool off, go take a walk. But for the most part, you know, if you're keen, you got to be at the screens. If otherwise, you're just going to miss opportunity. But you know, each to their own. I guess if the market's not doing that much, then sure, you know, take a bit of a long lunch.
Absolutely. Okay. All right, Bryce. Well, this has been awesome. I mean, I'm really glad that you said yes to an interview, because you've shared a lot of insight. I've found it really interesting myself, and I've no doubt that people listening will also. So yeah, thank you very much for doing this.
Mate, thanks for having me on. And I have to say thank you for keeping us punters up to date with an awesome resource. I mean, I'm still making my way through the past episodes, and it really is a goldmine of content that you're creating here for us. So keep it up, and I look forward to chatting again with you soon.
Awesome, no doubt. And just one last thing. Where can listeners get in touch with you? I mean, you mentioned your email before. Do you want people to email you?
Or, fine. I mean, I don't have a blog or anything like that, so email's probably the only contact. So it's my name, Bryce Edwards. The number's 80@gmail.com.
Okay, sure. And you're not on Twitter?
I am, but I don't really tweet.
Not very active?
No.
Fair enough. Okay. And alternatively, guys, as an alternative, just leave a comment on the website in case, you know, some people have similar questions. Bryce can answer everything in one place, and I think that could be a cool resource just to get a little bit more info as well for everyone. So yeah, if you have a question for Bryce, either email or in the comments on the website at chatwithtraders.com. All right, Bryce, take care, and let's talk again very soon.
Thanks, mate. Will do.
Hey, thanks so much for listening, team. I hope you really enjoyed this interview with Bryce. I'm sure we'll be hearing from him again at some point, so that's something to look forward to. If there are any questions you'd like to ask him, anything around day trading, the order book, catalyst for intraday moves, momentum, pretty much anything trading related, go to chatwithtraders.com/51 and drop a line in the comments area. Bryce is keen to answer your questions and help out, so please take advantage of this. And I also realized it's been a while since I mentioned the premium ebook that we have available here at Chat with Traders, titled Why Most Traders Never Succeed. So if you haven't had a chance to read this yet, or you haven't even heard of it, I strongly encourage you to check it out. Inside, you'll find the responses from 18 traders who have previously featured on the podcast, explaining the key reasons why most traders lose money and eventually crash and burn. To find out more about this ebook, which I've received really great feedback on from those who have read it, go to chatwithtraders.com/read, READ, and you can purchase a copy for just $15, and you'll pretty much get an email right away with an instant link to download. So again, that's chatwithtraders.com/read, READ, and you can purchase it right there on the site. All right, guys, I think we've covered plenty of ground again this week. Until next time, take care and we'll speak soon.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.